From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Whether you support medical marijuana in Utah or you oppose it, you have to admit Governor Gary Herbert's comments on the issue last month were funny, though I'm not sure he was trying to be.
I'm not interested in having Dr. Feelgood out there say, yeah, que pasa, you know, here's your doobie for the day and you'll feel better. That's probably not where I want to go.
The governor's office sort of backed away from the comment later, but actually a dated, reductive pop cultural reference is not a bad way of illustrating the unease some people are feeling about this stuff. And that's what we're talking about on the show today, the two bills making their way through the legislature this year. The politics, the science, maybe even the morality of medical marijuana in Utah. After the news.
KUER's volunteers give their time year-round to lend a helping hand. Our volunteers staff booths at special events, help with paperwork in our membership department, and assist the news and Radio West teams with behind-the-scenes details. Maybe you're a photographer or a graphic designer and you'd like to volunteer your skills. Or you have some spare time that you'd like to donate. We're always grateful for a little extra help from our friends. Find out more about volunteer opportunities at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Looks as though a bill that would legalize medical marijuana in this state is not going to pass in this year's legislative session, which is probably not a surprise to most of you. What does seem surprising is that a bill was presented at all in such a conservative state. Fact is, not just one, but two bills have been making their way through the session this year, one of them more restrictive than the other. It doesn't allow for products that include THC. That's the main chemical in marijuana, the one that gives people that euphoric feeling. The other bill does make the whole plant available to people afflicted with conditions like glaucoma and cancer and MS. But that's the bill that's making some lawmakers and the LDS Church nervous. Today in the program, we're breaking down the science and the politics of medical marijuana. You can join us if you have comments or questions. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Joining us on the program first is the sponsor of that bill I mentioned, which does make the whole marijuana plant available to people. It's Senate Bill 73. It's Senator Mark Madsen, a Republican, representing District 13 in the state Senate, which includes Saratoga Springs. He's the sponsor of that bill, 73, speaking to us from his office at the Capitol. And, Senator, thanks for making some time for us this morning. Welcome.
Great to be here. Good morning.
So I guess I want to get a sense, if you could just briefly tell us, what is it that got you thinking about this? And I think most people probably know that you yourself have talked about the fact that you've tried medical marijuana to deal with some chronic back pain. Is that sort of the beginning of what got you thinking about something like this for Utah?
In a sense, yes, it was. First, I'd like to say I hope that the rumors of SB 73's demise are premature.
Okay, okay. Sorry, maybe I misspoke.
Went through committee successfully. It's on the board. We're counting our votes, and our whip list looks okay.
When
the church came out about his statement about its concerns, I did lose a vote. One of my solids left on that, but we think it's still very viable, and you know the process is in play, and we'll negotiate and so forth. But to your question, that was to me, I first became aware of the medical aspect as I was going to specialists in different places around the country trying to deal with some of the things I'm suffering. But predated the experience we had a couple years ago when they brought the little epileptic kids onto the floor of the Senate. And that's the light bulb moment for me, because I realized it wasn't about me and my bad back. It was about people that were suffering a lot worse than I. And government was doing harm. It was denying relief to people. That's doing harm.
Right. You're an active Latter-day Saint. What kinds of moral qualms did you have about, first of all, just trying medical marijuana? I mean, because that seems like that's one of the issues that is a concern for people. And we'll get to this as we go, but that kind of moral component. But how are you thinking about it as a devout religious person?
Well, I didn't want to do anything that would put my immortal soul in jeopardy. So one of the first things I did after I talked to my physician and talked to my wife and did some original research was I went to my LDS bishop and explained my situation, told him I'd talk to my doctor, and told him I wanted to maintain my status as a member in good standing. And he said that as long as I did it in a state where it was legal, by according to state law, that I would be treated the same way any other LDS member who is in a state where they can do it legally and is doing it under a doctor's direction. And you can do that just like you can any other prescriptions. I've been prescribed opiates for many, many years and never had any question as to the moral injury or hazard there if I'm taking it as the doctor has prescribed it. Yeah. So, my concerns that I had initially were allayed. And I don't pick up in the church's statements that they're invoking a moral imperative. Their statements are kind of tweaking public policy, but I don't even read any kind of moral aspect to their statements that they're issuing this year.
See, but that's confusing to me because the church has always said and always maintained, and in fact has an official policy that they will not get involved in issues of public policy unless they have a community or moral consequence. So how does that square with what you just said? I'm not understanding why the church would be concerned. I mean, they certainly mention the federal law question. They're worried that it is federally illegal. They're worried that there's not enough research involved. But clearly they must have some moral qualms about it or they wouldn't have weighed in.
And again, we're speculating here. I wish I had a more clear understanding of the church's position and concerns, and whether it was moral concerns or whether it's just tweaking public policy. And I know that they say that they only weigh in under certain circumstances, but you might be surprised at how many issues they weigh in on.
Okay, that makes sense. There's this important difference. There's this important distinction between your bill and the bill proposed by your colleague, Senator Vickers,
sure,
and Representative Dawn. That is, of course, that yours allows the use of the whole marijuana plant, which means the THC. That's the, for those who are not aware, that's the chemical responsible for most of the sort of psychoactive effects.
THC, so, flavonoids, the terpenes, and the THC, everything.
Why is that the sort of offending substance? I mean, that's the one that seems to be worrying everyone. But why is that so important in your bill that that's included?
Well, the important element is that we have the plant the way, you know, God made it, not extracting out certain components like, you know, the pharmaceutical companies have extracted THC. They synthesized it. It's gone through all the FDA tests and the proofs, and it's available. It's very expensive, but it's called Marinol, and any physician with a DEA number can prescribe it now. So that's already available. It's already been tested. And some of the logic breaks down on, as people try and take the other position. What we did is we went to the science. And we looked especially at the other states. So we're boldly going where only 23 states have gone before. And we took the 9 conditions that the other states had selected. And some have more, but we took the 9 that every other of the 23 states recognizes. And then we started there, and then we went back and we looked at the science that supported that. And I've got a book. I've taken to carrying around a book of over 400 studies we pulled from the National Institutes of Health website to show by the condition in my book. So we let the science guide us. Some of that science is decades old, and based on those the science that supported those 9 conditions, then we tried to design a system that would get it to the people who are sick and who need it in a safe and efficient way, and not let it get out to the people who don't need it and who might abuse it. The other bill is based all on CBD, and CBD is a relatively new phenomenon. I think the first symposium was held in New York in 2013. When we adopted the CBD oil bill here, that the first there were 130 families, 130 kids that signed up. Second year, 80 of them came back, and that's a pretty good 80 of those kids, 55% saw a tremendous reduction in their seizures. Now, the other 45%. Didn't have that great result. Some of them have had the same great result with THC, though, and it's kind of cruel to say you can have relief from your epilepsy because you only need CBD to have that. But if you need the whole plant, you can't get relief from your seizures. Sorry, little kid.
Yeah.
Just keep seizing. But that's, again, the hypocrisy of some of this discussion here is that we follow the science and we pick the conditions based on that. The other bill starts with one element, one cannabinoid, CBD, that might have some exciting properties, especially for epileptic kids. Mm-hmm. But there's no other science. There's no other studies. They have conditions in the bill for which there is zero science on for CBD only. for example, phantom limb pain. I happen to have a cousin who had her leg amputated. She came to me early on. Can't I be in the bill? Can't I be in the bill? Some states recognize that. All don't. So we didn't. But the other bill says phantom limb pain. Well, I know there are studies on phantom limb pain treated with whole plant, with everything in it. I don't think there's a single study that says CBD would even be effective at all. What kind of relief are we offering the people in Utah if we're just doing kind of a study to see if CBD alone might help the way we already know whole plant does help?
Did Senator Vickers and Representative Daw have a real interest in getting a medical marijuana bill on the books, or were they just trying to create a more restrictive response to your bill?
You'd have to speak to them as to their motives. I know that the practical effect is that it provides an opportunity for my colleagues to make an easy vote to say they've done something to bring relief to people while they're really just not doing much of anything for anyone. I mean, it's a study. Maybe CBD in the long run, we find that it's very effective for some of these conditions. But my bill is designed to help the people that need the help right now based on the science we have now.
Senator Vickers has talked about one of the reasons to keep THC out of a potential law would be to avoid the increased use by young people. He's also said that if you strip the THC part out of it, that you keep us from that slippery slope of recreational use. How do you respond to that?
Well, again, I would respond with the facts and with the scientific studies that we have. And there are multiple studies. A few years ago, there was one in the Journal of Adolescent Health. More recently, in publications, the Lancet and so forth, showing that in the states, again, we have the experience, we have the data, these other 23 states that have medical cannabis programs, the teen use rate does not change. I don't know that anybody, Senator Vickers or anyone else, has produced a study, much less a study of that caliber, that indicates that teen use rates do go up, or that somehow this causes teens to use it more. By the time it's gone through all the testing and the processing that's required under the bill, it's very expensive, more expensive than I would like it to be to the patients. It's not competing with the weed that the kids can buy in their high school,
right,
you know, in 10 minutes. So some of these arguments are... an attempt, red herring type things, but you go through it logically, and we're just trying to, we don't want the people who are sick and who can get a documented, scientifically proven benefit from this to be thrown in jail. And we have examples of ladies being arrested in their wheelchairs and charged and having to go before the judge in Utah, fleeing the state. That's what we're trying to solve. Kids can get it in high school now. Kids will be able to get it in high school whether my bill passes or not. My bill is about not making patients criminals.
I wanted to ask you a little bit more about the position of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Of course, they came forward and opposed your bill. They say they don't object to the other one. And at first, you were somewhat frustrated, it seems, Senator, with parts of their objections because they didn't seem terribly specific. I think vague is the word, in fact, that you used. Do you feel like they've offered more sort of reasonable, now specific concerns that you can deal with, or do you still think in some way they lack a kind of specificity that you can actually grab hold of to talk about?
Well, again, I would like to assume that they're operating in good faith, and when they came out with their statement and they listed some specific areas of concern, that was legitimately what they were concerned about. And so I'm happy about that. I believe that the items that they brought up were the areas that they mentioned as far as the federal issue. There's a great explanation for that. This is unique, the way that the states have taken up this issue. It's a great 10th Amendment issue. Interesting Law Review article coined the phrase cooperative federalism because the federal government is actually cooperating with the states. Yeah. We have guidance from both the Obama administration and the Cole Memoranda telling us how to have these programs set up in states and avoid federal prosecution. And the Republican Congress has cut off all funding for federal enforcement in states where they have medical cannabis laws. So I think that there is an answer to the federal question, and there are answers to the unintended access and so forth. We have very, very strict measures in place in this bill, stricter than I think we've surveyed most of the states that have these programs. And I think we've set up one of the, if not the tightest program in the country. And our folks from our attorney general's office say that they can enforce it to the T, and make it a model. So I think that we, now that we have specifics, we can answer the specifics. If there's really some other issue lurking, if they're hiding the ball or not being forthright about what their real concerns are, then that's a different matter.
You lost one vote, you say? You think that was it? Because of the church?
Yeah, we went back through and we counted, and there was one of our yes votes that went.
You know, here's another thing that's kind of confusing about the church's position.
It probably solidified some no's, but only one yes.
Okay, right. Okay. There's Robert Gerke from the Salt Lake Tribune is going to join us a little bit later on the program, has been writing about this, and he wrote about Brian Stoll, who tells this story about using medical marijuana, went to his stake president, told him he needed to stop using it, or this was in Utah, because he wanted to get a temple recommended, and the stake president said, look, you've got to stop using medical marijuana or move to a state where it's legal.
Right.
So, and that's such an interesting sort of ironic thing in the sense that the church, the LDS church, is saying it's okay in Washington where it's legal. It's okay in other places. Yet here we're going to oppose making it legal here. I mean, does that seem contradictory or ironic to you?
Well, again, it just reinforces to me that there is no moral imperative here.
Right.
I mean, this is again tweaking, you know, state policy. And look, the church is a prominent player in the state. They're a major taxpayer. They have land holdings here. They're a major employer. They have every right to be involved in the discussion, the public dialogue. But generally, when people jump into the public forum, they offer specifics. And I think, again, the church has come back and they have articulated the areas, and many of them are the same concerns that anyone has when they take a first blush look at this and they're not real familiar with the data, the teen use data and some of the other studies, the opioid overdose. I mean, they talk about unintended consequences. What unintended or unexpected consequences would be greater than the known consequences, the lives that we would save in opioid overdose? I mean, what is the unintended consequence that's more important than saving lives? Let's have a frank and full discussion of all these things, and then let's let the people that were elected to make these decisions make the decisions.
When I referred earlier to the fact that it didn't seem like your bill was going to make it, I was just referring to some of the news reports that have said some of the advocates are conceding a sense of defeat. You sound pretty optimistic still. You're probably still counting votes. What are the chances? What do you give yourself?
Well, and I'll tell you, the fact that the folks came out and said that they're going to initiate this referendum or this initiative or start this initiative process.
Right, a ballot initiative.
Yeah, I can understand that, when the same week the church comes out against this, that they would be concerned and they want to have an insurance policy. My conversations with them is just, please give us a chance to get it done. Let your elected officials, the people you chose to do this, give us a shot at doing it right. But if we can't, then by all means, I support their initiative. However we get to the proper policy, however we restore this freedom to the people and we institute compassion in our policy, however we get there, I'm supportive of it.
But don't give up yet is what you're saying.
No, I would really prefer to have the legislature do it and do it right.
Senator Mark Madsen represents Utah's District 13, joined us from his office at the Capitol. Senator, we're grateful. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Ciao.
Ciao. 801-585-WEST, the number to join the conversation. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are talking about the possibilities of medical marijuana in Utah. Just a few years ago, the idea probably would have been ludicrous in such a conservative state, but not one. Two bills have been making their way through this year's legislative session. We've been talking about it today. We had with us earlier on the program Senator Mark Madsen, who has proposed one of those bills. Joining us now on the program is Robert Gerke, government reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. He's been covering this issue from the Capitol, and that's where he's joining us from. And Robert Gerke, welcome back to you. Thanks for being with us.
Yeah, happy to be here.
So I guess I wanted to start with, is it surprising that a medical marijuana bill, two bills in particular, one more restrictive than the other, even showed up in a place like this? Is that significant?
Well, I think it was a little surprising last year when Senator Madsen ran the bill the first time. Not necessarily, I guess, shocking, because as you probably are aware, there's 23 states in the District of Columbia that now have medical marijuana programs in place. And so this is not a new thing across the country, and it was probably just a matter of time before it came to Utah. But the politics of it are kind of interesting, because you've got somebody like Senator Madsen, who is a Republican and a pretty diehard Republican, but he's also got this sort of libertarian streak that plays into his support for this issue. And you've got some Republicans of a similar mindset, and you've got some Democrats who are behind this. So it's kind of an interesting unification, I guess, of the political interests that have come together to get behind this bill.
I asked Senator Madsen the question of whether the competing bill, Senate Bill 89, sponsored by Senator Vickers and Representative Daw, if that was just created as a way to sort of tamp down Madsen's efforts. What do you think?
Well, they insist that that wasn't the case. President Niederhauser was speaking at an event over the weekend, and he said that he believes that that was the case. And so, it's hard to divine somebody's intent in running a bill. It certainly has taken some of the wind out of the sails, though. So if that wasn't the intent, that's probably the practical effect.
So the offending substance seems to be, or one of them anyway, is the THC part of it. This Vickers-Daw version doesn't allow for the use of products containing THC. So I guess people are asking, and we'll be getting to this a little bit later in the program too, what's the point without the THC? I mean, because that seems, according to Senator Madsen, I mean, if you're going to do this at all, why not capture the full, power of that drug?
Yeah.
So what do you think? What is the point without the THC? Are people just hung up about the fact that it makes you high?
Well, I think that's the fear, yeah, is that, if you start having this available, then it makes it more attractive, as you talked about a little bit, about the desire to try to discourage youth from using and so forth. But Senator Vickers and Representative Daw kind of portray this as sort of a sensible first step. We want to be very cautious, and that was the word that the church used.
Yeah.
In sort of where we go with this, and so you've got these cannabidiol oils that are in some cases shown to be effective for some ailments, and so they think that's a sensible first step to take, where you don't have the potential risk of people that might get addicted or might get high on the marijuana. And so that's the argument. You take baby steps, I guess, is sort of how they're approaching it. And obviously you talk to Senator Madsen, you talk to some of the supporters who've said that, well, the Vickers bill really does nothing for a whole range of people. If you don't have the THC, if you don't have the whole plant, if you don't have all of the chemical compounds that come with that. So that's sort of the hang up. And I think what you may be sensing here at the Capitol is that there is concern about going too far, too fast, and the unintended consequences. And as the church again said, the need to be cautious on this front. And so I think there is some considerable support for that, for taking that sort of cautious approach.
But it's hard to say what they mean by unintended consequences. And this gets back to that question that I asked Senator Madsen, and that is, and I wanted to get your perspective on this. The church leaders have often said, we don't get involved unless it's a matter of community or moral consequence. So clearly they've got to see some sort of moral component here. And it seems like the idea, unintended consequences is a very vague way of getting at what seems to be, it would be fair to say, some moral concern, yes?
Yeah, I think that's what they're getting at. They don't want it to be a slippery slope, so to speak.
Right.
They don't want youth to see this as something that might be acceptable for, you know, their recreational use as opposed to using it for medicinal purposes. They don't want to see Utah follow what Colorado did and, you know, first legalize medical marijuana and then go to recreational marijuana. Now, I probably shouldn't be putting words in the church's mouth in this regard, but these are some of the concerns that have been expressed by others that, you know, this is not the direction that we want Utah to take. We don't want Utah to become, you know, Colorado or Washington or California. We want they want it to be very strictly regulated, have, you know, tight restrictions on it. So you know, these are the concerns that have been expressed by others. The church was a little more vague, obviously, in their statement. But, you know, you can kind of also sort of mirror this with their position on alcohol policy, right? They don't want anything that might lead to increased use. That's one of their guiding principles of alcohol. And I think that same principle probably holds true for this medical marijuana debate.
Where was the bill headed? I guess you can't tease apart now the Vickers bill and the Madsen bill, but where was the Madsen bill headed before the LDS Church got involved?
I think that Senator Madsen, you know, prognostications, I guess, but there was a lot of confidence that it had the votes to get through the Senate. You remember it fell a vote short last year,
right?
In the Senate. There was talk that it might have as many as 17 votes this time, which would have gotten it through. As Senator Madsen referenced, he's lost at least one of those votes, maybe two and more. Mm-hmm. So its prospects in the Senate are still pretty uncertain. Even the supporters acknowledge that the House was going to be a much tougher lift. And so even if it had gotten through the Senate this year, prospects in the House were probably not rosy. And I think this, again, this statement by the church makes it very uncertain it'll, you know, get through the Senate. And I would, you know, as the advocate said yesterday, dead on arrival in the House.
Yeah. Would you explain, give us a sense of the protecting parents part of the bill?
Yeah.
That seems a really interesting component. Just sort of lay that out for us, because I'm guessing most people don't know what I'm talking about.
Well, there are two pieces to it. So one is, you know, if I'm using medical marijuana, I have my medical marijuana card, but I also have children, you know, there is the potential that DCFS could come and say, well, you know, you're using drugs around your kids, and so we're going to, you know, intervene in this situation. It is a crime to use drugs around children, and also, you know, and the other piece of it that Senator Madsen's bill is unique in is that a doctor can recommend use of these medical marijuana compounds for children. You know, there was one woman we spoke with recently who was using this for her child that had a pituitary malformation, and it was causing a lot of health problems for her. And she said she started using it when she was in Oregon, and it you know, changed the kid's life. But then DCFS showed up at her door, and she sort of went into a panic. You know, she was worried that she was going to lose her children for giving her child these marijuana compounds. And so, you know, the Madsen bill would allow parents to do that and not have to worry about being charged with crimes or lose their children to, you know, Child Protective Services.
The LDS Church, they came back and sort of clarified. I mean, Senator Madsen was one who said, look, you're not being specific, you're being kind of vague. So the church did, in its defense, come back and make some clarifications. And we've talked about some of those. One of them is the church is concerned for some reason that there is an inconsistency in state and federal law.
Yeah.
Now, give us a sense of why that would bother them, because it doesn't seem to keep leaders from approving its use in states where medical marijuana is legal. I'm confused about that.
Right. I don't have a good answer for you on that, because there is a clear inconsistency there. You know, if you are on one side of the Colorado Utah border, it's okay according to the church, and if you're not, it's not okay because of the federal law and the state law. So it becomes a matter of geography in a lot of ways. And so, you know, obviously the church is not going to encourage people to break the law, but they also, you know, acknowledge at least that in those states where they have legal medical marijuana programs, that they condone that. So there is definitely an inconsistency there. And I'm not exactly sure how they square those two things, from a policy and a, you know, from a policy standpoint.
Right. So let's ask about going forward. You were mentioning it, the chances don't look great for Senator Madsen this year. And it, as you were writing this morning or yesterday in the paper, talking about the fact that the advocates are now sort of conceding they may have lost at this time and they're going to take up the issue. They're going to try to take it to the ballot. And you've written about the complications there. There's a lot involved, town hall meetings, more than 100,000 signatures. What are the chances of getting it on a ballot? Because, and maybe we should mention this, mainstream Utahns seem to be supportive of the idea of medical marijuana, even Mormons.
Right. We've done some polling at the Tribune that showed that over 60% of Utahns support medical marijuana programs, including about half of the Mormon population, you know, and more approved it than did not. So there is public support out there, presumably. I'm curious to see, frankly, when our new polling comes out, what the church's statement may, how that
right,
may have influenced
right,
that.
Right.
But the challenges they have are pretty steep, as you mentioned, and their time frame is short. They've only got until April 15th to get this done. They've got to get a legal and a fiscal policy impact review done. They've got to have 7 town hall meetings. They've got to and then they've got to go out and gather these 100,000 signatures. And if you look at the calendar, that's a pretty tight time frame. But there are, you know, they have talked to professional signature gathering companies that do this for a living, and you know, it is possible to get it done. But it's gonna take a lot of money. Now that's the plus side for, I guess, the advocates is that they've got some wealthy financial backers who are throwing their weight behind this. Patrick Byrne from
right.
Overstock
yeah.
and Bruce Bastian and some others.
Pete Ashdown, you mentioned.
So there's some money behind this movement. So it's going to be kind of a scramble. I think the other thing that they're kind of looking at as well is Senator Madsen has said he's not going to run for re-election. And you've got a couple other supporters who are in the Senate who are not going to be running for re-election. And so the future for a bill like Senator Madsen's is not rosy, I think, given that the changes that'll be occurring in the body when they come back into session next year.
Robert Gerke, government reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune, joined us from the Capitol. Robert, thanks again.
Yeah, thank you.
We're going to take a brief break and be back in a moment to sort of deal with the question, which is the argument the LDS Church has made and others that there's a lack of research on the benefits and the potential harms of medical marijuana. Well, is there? We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we've been talking about the possibilities of getting a medical marijuana bill through a conservative Utah legislature. As you've heard, there are some problems with that, and the chances don't appear to be so good, though Senator Mark Madsen, the sponsor of one of those bills, is at least hopeful. Joining us now on the program is Judy Foreman, who's a health journalist and the author of the book A Nation in Pain, which looks at how chronic pain is treated in this country and includes a chapter on medical marijuana. She's joining us from her home in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And Judy Foreman, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
So from what you're hearing so far, can you give us a sense? I just want to sort of start with a kind of a prologue about how fraught this issue is. Obviously, it always has been. The baggage of morality, the baggage of everything that seems to come with marijuana. I mean, that's where you have to start, I guess, right? You have to get past that if you're going to really get to anything else. This is a really fraught issue.
Yeah, marijuana is a fraught issue. So is chronic pain.
Right.
So the larger issue, as my book goes into considerable detail, is, you know, there is an enormous chronic pain epidemic in this country, and with like 100 million Americans suffering from chronic pain. Not all severe pain, but a good 10, somewhere between 10 and 30% in severe disabling pain. And yet we pay almost no attention to that problem. We're very focused in the press on the opioid epidemic, mm-hmm. which is real, but only half of the problem. The other half is undertreated and dismissed chronic pain in a lot of people. And so that's fraught. And then the whole history of marijuana in this country is very fraught. It's you were mentioning the research, and a major problem has been that the government has basically controlled the only legal source of kind of top grade marijuana plants from a farm. I think it's in Mississippi, and that's the only place you can get legal marijuana to study, and they dole it out very sparingly. And most of the government research to date has been aimed at looking for harms and not for benefits. Mm. So the whole research picture in this country has been very skewed. Luckily, that's not the case in Canada and some other countries. So there is a lot of research. Unfortunately, the American research community has been sort of struggling to get their hands on this stuff in sufficient quantities to really answer some of the questions that people have.
You know, it's interesting. In your book, you write about it was in 1970 that marijuana was classified as a Schedule I drug. That's the sort of worst classification. But before that, right. You say laws in all states actually allowed exceptions for using marijuana as a medicine?
Yeah. Why they put it in Schedule I is beyond comprehension. I mean, to be in Schedule I, as you said, that's the worst category. And that means there's no, according to the law, there's no medical benefit and there's a high potential for harm. Neither of those things is true for marijuana. I mean, it's in the same category with heroin and LSD and all these other things that do have dangers. The addiction risk with marijuana is really quite low, and the potential benefits are, depending on what disease you're looking at, can be significant. So it really, that's a whole issue of does it belong in Schedule I or not? And scientifically, the answer is absolutely it doesn't. But politically, it's proven hard to get it out of that category.
Is it the stoned part? It's the fact that people get high. I mean, this is something you write about, how you untease, because there seems like there's this effort to sort of untease the psychoactive effects, you know, the high part from the painkiller part. But right. It seems like it's hard to tease those apart because they're sort of connected in important ways.
Well, they're certainly both in the whole plant, as Senator Madsen was talking about. And there's some evidence that you actually can't get as much pain relief with just the CBD, just the cannabidiol, that you may need some of the THC, the tetrahydrocannabinol, to kind of boost the pain reducing effect. So it's not clear at all that, although it's scientifically interesting to separate these things, in terms of medical efficacy, it may not be worth it. You may really need the whole plant to get the right proportions of things. And that's, you know, that's actually true for, you know, are you better off eating carrots or taking a vitamin? It's sort of true in general throughout nutrition that, you know, eating the real thing is probably better than getting something in a pill. So that isn't particularly surprising.
Let's talk about the basic question, which you were referring to, this idea of how safe marijuana is. No deaths to attribute to marijuana.
I was just going to say zero deaths, no deaths from marijuana itself. Now, if you're going to take it and drink, you know, a gallon of whiskey and then drive, those other factors can kill you. But marijuana by itself is not fatal. And the reason is actually very simple. Unlike opioids, marijuana does not suppress breathing. When people die of an opioid overdose, basically they stop breathing. And that's what happens. And that's why this antidote, naloxone, can be so effective in helping reduce the opioid deaths. With marijuana, you don't stop breathing. And so the death risk is really very, it's not there. In terms of addiction and dependence, and these figures I looked up today, they are from the National Institute on Drug Abuse. So they're government figures. Right. Marijuana is pretty low in the risk of getting hooked. And, you know, if you want, we can go into the difference between addiction and dependence because they are different. But tobacco is the most addictive substance, followed by heroin, then cocaine, then alcohol, and way down at the bottom, marijuana, 9%. So there is a risk, but it's way smaller than the things we sort of don't even bat an eye about.
Well, I want to get back to benefits and risks here in a moment. But one thing you write about is the sort of the biological component here, which I thought was really interesting, because you say all human beings and a lot of other creatures, mammals in particular, have these cannabinoid receptors. So why would it that why would we evolve? Why would our nervous system be so full of these receptors? I mean, you ask that question
itself. Isn't that a great question?
Yeah, what is the deal?
I mean, we not only have, they're called endo, meaning sort of in the body automatically, endocannabinoid receptors. That's receptors for marijuana-like substances. We also make in our bodies marijuana-like substances that go in those receptors. So it's like we're a little marijuana system just from birth, and we're not the only mammals that have this. So obviously there's something that evolution has thought worth hanging on to that we have it. And it appears that this system at a very kind of base level helps people relax, sleep, have appetite stimulation, generally have a kind of a calming effect on the body. And people who are, there's some interesting data on people who are born with not enough of these receptors or not enough of these natural marijuana-like substances are more susceptible to certain pain syndromes than other people. So there's a whole intrinsic biology. You know, you could sort of say we're wired to be on our own internally generated marijuana. This is not the plant that's out there, but, you know, internally. But it makes sense that then when you stumble upon this plant, it fits into the system that's already in place.
So our
it's fascinating, really. It's really interesting. And it appears actually that we always think of the runner's high as only due to endorphins, but apparently that's also due to that running and vigorous exercise may stimulate this endocannabinoid system. So there's a lot to this that, aside from the politics, is just interesting science.
So our prehistoric ancestors weren't necessarily looking to get stoned. They were trying to deal with pain. That's been the principal sort of...
Yes. Of course, who knows? They may have been trying to get stoned as
right,
well.
Right.
But I don't know quite what the cavemen were up to. But yeah, this is a natural system that exists. And it's very interesting. And that the argument or the discussion that you were having earlier about the one bill in the legislature that would be cannabidiol only versus the whole plant thing, that's a very interesting discussion scientifically. And from what I've learned, the data really support the whole plant idea as being more effective. People, I mean, doctors can write prescriptions for synthetic, you know, for pharmaceutical marijuana, but in general, pain patients don't find those things as effective for pain as the whole plant. The other interesting thing is when people are using marijuana medicinally for pain relief, they tend to be very sort of responsible and cautious about it. They titrate their doses very well. Like I talked to one lady with trigeminal neuralgia who they call it the suicide disease because the pain in the face can be so terrible. She would take one puff and that would be enough. That produced a feeling that the pain moved, in her words, like a foot off her face. Sensorily, she was aware that the pain was still there, but emotionally, it provided a bit of distance from the pain. And that seems to be an interesting way that the whole plant marijuana works, which is to help in the brain separate the emotional processing of the pain from the sensory aspect of the pain, which is interesting. And people who use it for that seem to get very good at just taking the right amount to function and not to get high.
Let me go through a few of the benefits and risks thing, but I wanted to start with this question of dependence and addiction, because in your book, you write about the fact that doctors, federal agencies, a lot of people kind of confuse the two terms. What's the difference between dependence and addiction?
Okay. Dependence is sort of the lesser evil, if you will. If you take any substance, I mean, even insulin or opioids or marijuana, you can become dependent. Your body gets used to it. Like with opioids, the receptors for opioids in your nervous system are used to being full of opioids or whatever substance we're talking about. And if you suddenly take that away, your body will react. That's dependence. But there's not necessarily harm in implicit in dependence. Addiction is beyond that. It is using the drugs to have effects beyond the medicinal, to get high, is taking the drugs knowing that they're going to cause you harm and taking them anyway. It's even committing crimes to get the drugs. It's a much more serious neurological condition. And people get those things confused all the time. And there is a fine line. I mean, you know, it's not 100% clear. But people mix up the terms all the time, which makes things even harder. But there is what scientists consider an important distinction there.
There's something I
wanted to mention, if you don't mind.
No,
about,
go ahead. Of course.
Potential benefits of marijuana. And that is a couple of years ago in the Journal of the American Medical Association, there was a very interesting story or article about states that had legalized marijuana saw a decrease in deaths from opioids. It seems as though if people are using marijuana to combat pain, they can take lower doses of opioids. There's sort of a synergistic effect, or possibly even skip the opioids altogether. You know, that is preliminary research, and it fits other preliminary research. Much more research would have to be done to make that a really powerful political argument. Mm-hmm. But there is data that, and this was, you know, an important study, that the states that had legalized marijuana had many fewer opioid-related deaths. So it seems that this is a much more benign way to control pain than opioids. And that's important to remember when we're considering all these different risks and benefits.
What do you make of the argument that always comes up about the fact that you're inhaling something, you're smoking something? I mean, on some level, I think in your book you talk about in many ways it's the most effective way of getting THC into the system, of course, but then the question of respiratory problems are always raised. What do we know about that?
What we know, which is interesting, is that it doesn't seem to raise the risk of lung cancer. That was everybody's big concern. That doesn't seem to be the case. Smoking anything is a really crummy delivery system. I mean, you really don't want any of this stuff in your lungs. But vaporizing, people can smoke marijuana through a pipe that kind of bubbles away and cools it down a little bit. So you can kind of offset some of the respiratory risks by vaporizing. And some of the researchers who study this do recommend that as a way of smoking it without incurring those respiratory risks, or at least not to the same degree. And it does seem to be otherwise a pretty good drug delivery system, because it does work fast. And working fast counts because then you don't tend to take too much. You sort of pause and say, oh, wow, the pain is a little bit less. I can stop. I don't have to take any more.
There are a list of concerns. We don't have time to sort of go through all of these, you know, cognitive questions about what effect it may have on cognitive issues, psychiatric issues, whether schizophrenic, whether it raises the risk of psychosis, and especially schizophrenia, those kinds of things. Without going through all of those, I wonder, is there one particular risk that you think is still a big question, one that you could worry about?
Well, I do worry about the cognitive stuff in teenagers whose brains are still developing.
Yeah.
I mean, one reason teenagers act like teenagers is that their prefrontal cortexes are not really fully developed yet.
Yeah.
And, you know, you don't really want a lot of substances messing with that process. So there is some concern about that. It appears to be dose related. So, you know, really heavy users are presumably at more risk than, relatively minor users. But that, you know, I don't want my grandkids using it. Not that they'll listen, but you know, that is some concern. On the other hand, some of the data shows that the kids who are most likely to suffer those deficits are kids who are on a bad track anyway academically, that they weren't necessarily, you know, studying and taking school seriously and being good doobies to start with.
Yeah.
So it's a little hard. It's hard to sort some of that out. But you know, there is some concern about that. In terms of the schizophrenia and the psychosis risk, that is a concern. On the other hand, some of the big epidemiological studies show that there isn't an increase in schizophrenia, even as the use of marijuana has gone up. So again, I would say the jury is out on that. But it, you know, it's a theoretical concern, and schizophrenia is a really serious disease, so you don't really want to take any unnecessary chances with that. For older people with more or less fully formed brains who are taken for pain, those conditions become less of a concern.
You've talked about the fact that, and this is always the case, it seems, when we're talking about marijuana, is people talk about the slippery slope and the fact that it's a gateway drug. But you say in the book, it's underage drinking, really, and smoking are
right.
More the gateway drug than anything.
That's absolutely right. That's absolutely right. And it's kids, you know, young kids using those drugs, which are both legal, both alcohol and tobacco are illegal, but it's the kids who use them and use them to excess illegally. Those are the ones who start down a path of drug using. So, yes, it's really alcohol and tobacco, which, by the way, kill a lot more people than opioids and marijuana and basically anything else. Those are the real gateway things. So there's a big psychosocial, societal influence on all this. I mean, the people who are most likely to get into trouble with drugs, you know, it may not be the drugs that the issue. It may be their life conditions that are pretty horrible, with poverty or violence or abuse and sort of situations that are really difficult, and people turning to some substance to try to alleviate their psychological pain.
Less than a minute. Let me ask you this finally. Something you've proposed is seeing marijuana not just as legalizing it and taxing it. You say treat it as a dietary supplement.
Yeah, I'm probably the only one thinking about that. The reason I think that is you really want to be able to get good quality marijuana. I went to a marijuana conference a couple of years ago, and there were some horror stories about people growing it and then it getting moldy, and so you're inhaling mold or other toxic substance kind of growing on the plants. Or if you buy it on the street, you don't know what percent THC and CBD are in it. I mean, if we could regulate it so you could buy it anywhere and know that what it said on the label was really what was in the plant, that would be very helpful, because otherwise it's kind of a crapshoot.
Yeah.
And that's not good. That is not good.
It's Judy Foreman. Her book is called A Nation in Pain, Healing Our Biggest Health Problem. Joined us from her home in Cambridge. Judy, thanks very much for the time.
You're very welcome.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Sophie Sirois and to KUER's Terry Gilday. Tim Slover is our technical director. Producer for Video West is Josh Weathers. Radio West, produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.